There is no state in the Union, hardly any spot of like size on the globe, where the man of color has lived so intensely, made so much progress, been of such historical importance, and yet about whom comparatively little is known. His history is like the Mardi Gras of the city of New Orleans, beautiful and mysterious and wonderful, but with a serious thought underlying it all. When Alice Dunbar Nelson wrote People of Color in Louisiana back in 1917, she was referring to a group of people with the heritage of forebears who were neither slave nor completely free. From the Battle of New Orleans to the groundbreaking Supreme Court case Plessy versus Ferguson and the fight against Jim Crow, what did free persons of color have to say about turning points in American history? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
In a time when laws about housing, transportation, and education were based on a black-white distinction, how did persons of mixed race fit in? What's the difference between Cajun and Creole? And how did the legacy of the French affect attitudes about race in New Orleans? Our guest is Jennifer Gibson, professor in the French and Italian Department of the UW-Madison.
Well, welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you all very much.
Well, let's start with your topic. It seems a kind of unusual topic to look at free persons of color in New Orleans.
Well, one does not find very much usual in New Orleans. Actually, it's quite a logical topic. There's been, I'm approaching this from the perspective of literature and literary history, but there's been some excellent work on it from historians lately. And what we are dealing with is, well, basically the fact that, as I said, New Orleans is unusual, and there so much of what structured 19th century New Orleans and arguably still a good part of Louisiana today simply flies in the face of the Anglo-American racial binary and many cultural conventions and norms. And so when we speak of the free persons of color, and I'm largely going to speak of Creoles of color or Creoles de couleur in the sense that we are dealing with both the antebellum days before the Civil War, when the distinction free was quite pertinent, though perhaps not wholly accurate in its meaning, and indeed in up until the early 20th century and late 19th century, we were speaking of Plessy versus Ferguson, and it's one of those things that has gone down in American history, which gave us separate but equal, of course, and so few people see that name and then see the name of Omer Plessy behind it, or his Comité des Citoyens, the Activist Citizens Committee, who actually staged his test case. Homer Plessy was arrested on the East Louisiana Railroad. This was a deliberate test case. He was 7/8 white. And that is a profound, profound point in American history that ushers in decades of Jim Crow, but not without comment from the people who were behind this and who were fighting against what the end result was, and not without comment that happened in French, even in the 20th century.
So, how did this blending of New Orleans begin in the first place?
Well, as I think of it, there was probably some French explorer who was so busy slapping mosquitoes that he decided this would really be a good place to put a city and just gave up right then and there. This blending of New Orleans begins at a blending of the land and the water, and the fact that, yeah, it's a nice bend in the Mississippi, but not necessarily the best place to have put a city. And if I were to sum up the history of Louisiana, I used to do this in three dates. When I was teaching introductory French classes, I would do 1682, De La Salle claims what would later be the Louisiana Territory for the King of France, who, being King of France, I'm sure was named Louis. He was at the time, indeed. In 1803, Napoleon sells Louisiana to the United States for $15 million, 3 cents an acre, best real estate deal ever. They had really just gone to try and get right of deposit at New Orleans, and they got what is now, what, a third of our country, almost. Of course, in between there, we're switching, you know, hands to the Spanish, back to the French. And did the French ever really own it in the first place, if you ask the native peoples who were there? And my third date would be 2005, when some of Louisiana asked the French to buy them back. buy us back Chirac is some of the post-Katrina lore that surfaced after Katrina, the buy us back Chirac satirical positions, and then some of the Mardi Gras floats in 2006. I later revised it to Eddie Fourth Date when the Saints won the Super Bowl, and somebody hollered, "Bon temps, laissez les bon temps rouler," on national television. And in seeing what had happened then, I said that I thought that it had been last time the state of Louisiana had such good news, Andrew Jackson was involved. So the Battle of New Orleans might need to be an important date on there, and I think it's going to be one that we'll want to revisit later in this program in talking about the militia of free men of color who fought alongside Andrew Jackson and the pirates and everyone else.
Can you talk about, you used the term Creole. Can you talk about that term, also Cajun, because these terms come up quite frequently in conjunction with Louisiana and not always with the same meaning?
Oh, no. And we could actually talk about that for the entire hour and very, very much more. So if we're speaking of ethnic labels, not of languages, because Louisiana Creole, French lexifier Creole, born of the slave trade, is a different, putting language aside and thinking about ethnic labels, Creole is a highly contested and, in fact, litigated term.
Litigated?
Oh, yes, definitely. A lot of some of the historians whose work I have been reading are looking at how race is defined through the courts and how those definitions are, in large part, ignored in many cases. Originally, Creole was a pan-racial term that indicated origin in Louisiana or in the colony. With emancipation and with the influx of outsiders in Reconstruction and the black-white Anglo-American binary coming into force, there's profound anxiety over the term Creole, and it starts to mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I would call it a canvas for ethnic identity because we will have the descendants of the free people of color claiming Creole at the end of the 19th century. In fact, someone who was quite prominent in the Citizens Committee in the Plessy versus Ferguson case, Rolf de Dune, who writes, basically, I would call it Creole hagiography, the history of his people, but from a certain perspective, using Creole. And we will also have white French speakers, and this is actually a topic which is very, very central to a piece of research that I'm working on right now, trying to whitewash the word Creole and saying it never meant anything but, quote, pure European origins. And they'll go so far as to rename the Creole language Gombo, using a Creole word, which, you know, could mean okra or could mean that, you know, that culinary association of something which is necessarily a mixture, so as to distance the word Creole from the Creole language, from the racial associations of Creole speakers, and claim it for themselves.
So now when you're defining these Creole people of color, this would be people who had slave ancestry of some sort and in some way a mixture of French. And, you know, again, to define, I mean, to be included in this category, would you be looking at someone who was one-eighth, like you said, one-eighth?
Very much so. Yeah. Octoroon, I mean, in the qualifications. For the most part, the free people of color did not become free as a result of manumission, that is, being freed as slaves. In large part, this was when we see the population boom to about 15,000 in the late 1840s or 1850s. And free persons of color, by the way, were, I think, one-third of the New Orleans population, city of New Orleans, not the state of Louisiana, in 1810. And what we're seeing happening is the revolution in Saint-Domingue, Haiti. And there is an influx of French-speaking, largely Roman Catholic, free persons of color into the city of New Orleans, several thousand. And we're also seeing a natural increase in the community simply by marriage and birth. And the very peculiar to outsiders, as we see in visitors' accounts, New Orleans institutionalized disregard for laws against miscegenation. Which is to say, laws were in the books, and people had been trying to legislate sex in Louisiana for a really long time. And there's some fine work by a historian by the name of Jennifer Speer on that in looking at the colonial period. that didn't go so well. And this institutionalized disregard resulted in a practice that was called plaçage, where a free woman of color, generally mixed race, would be placed, put into an established relationship with a predominantly European white man, sometimes with ecclesiastical blessing.
So a marriage or a mistress situation?
It's not a marriage. It's a plaçage. In one of the stories that we can talk about today, it was called a marriage of consciousness because it was blessed by the priest, but it was blatantly against the law. Yet it was so ingrained in New Orleans society that if you've ever heard of the quadroon balls, the quatrain, these were balls in which the free women of color, and quadroons being one quarter African blood, and considered to be basically the height of beauty, these were balls in which white men would meet their prospective place in which these unions would be formed. And we see references to balls and some very explicit references, daring, if I might say, to plaçage into these balls in the literature of free men of color, which I find fascinating because they were the ones who were excluded from this particular space. They were excluded from the sexual economy of plaçage. They were excluded from the society of the quadroon balls. And in some of what I'd like to talk through today, part of basically the thesis of something I'm working through right now, is that the exclusion of plaçage that the man of color experiences in plaçage replicates a much more generalized exclusion and marginalization. And so in narrating, in what might not be historically accurate terms, how they saw this institution as basically bondage, as Creole mothers whom they're blaming for selling the daughters for financial gain, that as they portray this and portray the plight of the woman, what we are not finding, we're not finding an archive of the free woman's voice. We're finding an archive of these writers' personal concerns and perhaps a means of self-narration in this defense of the women of their community.
This plaçage, this was not by any means a coercive thing, but it was just an economically expeditious choice?
Well, it totally depends who you ask. I mean, some contemporary historians have a view of plaçage which says that women of color did what they had to do within the system, and it was perhaps the best means that they had to attain financial and social stability, and that it was simply, in sense, bound to happen. If you look at the colonial days when there are disproportionate populations and complex legislation of sex in colonial Louisiana, if you look at the writers I'm talking about in the 1840s, the free men of color, it is paramount to prostitution and moral ruination. So I am, in general, much less interested in what really happened. I'm not a historian. Than I am in what do writers portray as happening, and without it needing to be historical fact, what is it that they try to do with this? And so the significance of these narratives, of these plaçage stories, and some of them are very indirect, for me is not a historical archive, but an archive of what writers did, how they portrayed this institution to speak about their own reality, in a sense. And how this particular institution, which is of interest to historians, certainly, for myself as a literary historian, could be viewed as an example of how literature encodes, creates a cultural code that is legible in that context, a literary shorthand for race and class distinctions at a time when their explicit evocation in things being published, mind you, in the antebellum South, would have been a bit less permissible than it was, say, for Victor Séjour publishing in Paris, France.
Would it be fair to say that the writers that you are working with are really not well known, that most of us, if we know of depictions of someone who's quadroom or whatever the, you know, insulting term would be, and people from Louisiana, we know it maybe through Kate Chopin, or we might know it through Faulkner or through some other white writer, but that the writers of color from this region are not well known at all.
The writers are not well known, but the legends and the lore surrounding the quadroons and the institution of Plaçage definitely is, and I am really very interested in exploring how this survives in the cultural imaginary, in that you could still, if you looked like you knew your way around New Orleans a little bit but still needed directions somewhere, be given the former quadroon ballroom as a reference point of where to turn. If any of y'all have read any Anne Rice, the vampire mm-hmm. stories, right? She has a book called The Feast of All Saints, which is about free persons of color in New Orleans. And, I mean, even Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen, right? Country music, another man done gone. Marie Laveau, down in Louisiana where the black trees grow, lives a voodoo lady named Marie Laveau. A free woman of color who certainly still has a place in the cultural imaginary and tourist stops to New Orleans cemeteries. So these texts are, while not necessarily archives of historical fact, are still historical and literary archives of the voices of the men of this community that are not known. And we'll even find a white woman outside of New Orleans, writing in the late 19th century stories called Les Quatre Hommes, the Quadroons of New Orleans, in which these women are portrayed as not just a seductive charm, but something magical that can very much bring about the ruination of the men involved. Wherein the writers we're looking at are speaking, in essence, of the ruination of the women of their own community, women who are being taken out of their reach, in essence, and being placed with the white men, perhaps involuntarily, perhaps, you know, with complicitly, and perhaps as a way to advance themselves. But these are not the voices that we hear in these works.
We'll hear some of those voices from writers, free persons of color in antebellum New Orleans to begin with, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Jennifer Gibson, who is telling us about the rich and colorful history of New Orleans and, to some extent, Louisiana as well, especially as influenced by the original French culture. One term that we touched on and then we didn't go back to get a real definition of, speaking of the French, is Cajun. So it comes from Acadian originally, but what does that really do for us when we know that?
Right, so Cajun, French, truncated from Acadien, of course, Cajun. And I think the question is often framed as Cajun versus Creole. Mm. Well, the Cajuns predominantly centered in southwest Louisiana, so we're talking largely west of the New Orleans metropolitan area, the greater New Orleans area, or descendants of the Acadien, expelled from Nova Scotia by the British, of course, and who eventually settled in French-speaking Louisiana, where they, you know, Catholic faith, French-speaking area. And Cajuns today, I mean, we think of Cajun music. We probably think of food and no doubt many kinds of seasoning and all of the many things that have been sold and labeled with the word Cajun. But it also represents another part of the linguistic puzzle piece, if you will, of grasping Louisiana, in that Cajun French is French that left France. Largely, I'm thinking the 17th century, settles in Canada and evolves isolated from the French mainland and then ends up in Louisiana. And so you can find pieces of French French that no longer persist in France that survive in Cajun French that in a sense make it, quote, more French.
Than French.
And I say that. The look on my face does not translate well for radio. But
do you mean in a sense that there are archaic French expressions that are still part of the Cajun language?
Or things in French French that have been replaced with English. A cowboy versus un vaché, or un dollar versus un piastre.
The Académie française notwithstanding.
Pardon?
The Académie française notwithstanding.
I make it my business to make a face at them every time I pass the Institut de France. The Académie française notwithstanding. It's all good and fine to tell people how to speak French, but the reality is that French colonization, both the language, and it's something very germane to my own work on 19th century France, the folklore spread outside of mainland France. And with colonial loss, we start to see anxiety about, oh, what are they doing with our traditions and how can we get them back because they don't survive here anymore? And at what point is it French folklore if it's outside of France? Or is it even French folklore if it's happening in Louisiana Creole, that language that is born of the slave trade and the meeting of French and African languages and this necessity of communication? So I hope that answers a little bit about Cajun. Cajun is certainly still spoken in Louisiana today, and the public radio station in Lafayette, Louisiana, if you catch it at exactly the right time at 7 a.m., there used to be, I haven't tried this in a few years, this odd moment of linguistic transition where somebody would say, they've been broadcasting in French for 2 hours. Restez à l'écoute pour morning edition. And in the space of this sentence, this linguistic transition to it is now 7 a.m. and we will speak English. So French certainly still exists in Louisiana, and a lot of people, Council on Development of French in Louisiana and others, very much working for it. I am on the editorial board of the Edition Tintemar, Centenary College of Louisiana, which prints 19th century and contemporary text. And so, some of the writings of the Creoles of color, many of these texts hadn't seen print since 19th century newspapers.
And I'm still not quite clear on the difference between Cajun and Creole. If you were in an elevator and you had 30 seconds to clarify what the absolute difference is between Cajun and Creole, how would you say it?
Cajun, easy to clarify, Creole not. Creole, highly conflicted term, has meant white, has meant mixed, has meant of African origin, has meant of French, Spanish, has meant only French. It is a canvas, in my opinion, for ethnic self-definition. In its current usage, is much more likely to refer to a certain mixed identity that does not fit into this black, white, or African-American sense. In the 19th century, it could have meant any of those number of things, and people were simultaneously advancing it to mean very different things in the face, again, of increasingly and looming Americanization and this idea, this utter incongruence of lived reality and the Anglo-American racial categories and concepts of race. And so Creole is a term that a variety of people are falling back on, black and white, to try and preserve their sense of their own identity, which is left over from this tripartite social structure in the antebellum days, where we have slavery in Louisiana, we have free and white in Louisiana, and then we have free persons of color, who, by the way, could be slaveholders. And so this does not fit with this master-slave dialectic, with the governing historical paradigms that most of the time we come to this time period in mind with. And so you see remnants of this Creole de couleur, this antebellum free elite of color that after the Civil War just doesn't get absorbed into the black-white binary. You see at the end of the 19th century, and certainly I want to speak about this at greater length later on, Rudolf Dedun, who is writing a book called Nos Hommes, Notre Histoire, Our People, Our History, writing to W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the leading voices of African Americans at the time, and it's a few words to Dr. Du Bois, with malice towards none, and disagreeing with his portrayal of the person of color in the American South, because this is an identity that is constructed around the French language, that can't escape the African-American reality or some degree of an alliance with some of these political causes, but is constructed around the French language, at least up until a certain point, that is quoting French philosophers, Montesquieu and everybody else, that is American and yet is looking to the hexagon, to France, as the motherland, still to some extent.
How far back does black ancestry make one a person of, not person of color so much, but just legally in Louisiana, a person subject to something like placage? I mean, we're talking about quadroons. Octoroons were also known.
Right.
But at what point is it just kind of forgotten that there's even that drop of tar in there?
Oh, complicated. That kept a lot of courts busy. That kept a lot of gossip busy. That kept a whole lot busy in 19th century Louisiana. And with placage, there's another P we have to bring up, and that is passing.
Oh, yes.
Passing for white, because many of these people who, by the way, had their own school in New Orleans, had their own literary journal, or we'll talk shortly, I imagine, about their poetry collection. Many of them elsewhere would have probably passed for white. Homer Plessy, 7/8 white on the East Louisiana Railroad, had to declare that he did not belong in the whites-only car in order to get arrested. And so passing is another very different problem. And we have a famous court case, in the very famous court case in the 1850s, and Tukotu is the woman's nickname. Very well treated in a 2009 book called Exiles at Home by Shirley Thompson, subtitled The Struggle to Become American in Creole New Orleans. And hers is a very sensitive treatment of the Tukotu case, which a lawsuit essentially accusing somebody of slander and Tukotu, which was not her real name, trying to prove herself white in the court. She did not succeed, and she became the subject of much ridicule, and including a taunting song in Creole, not in French. So we are moving a little more marginalized linguistically and racially. A song called Tukotu, in which the beginning is, or the chorus rather, is, "Hey, Tukotu, I know you. There's not enough soap in the world to bleach your skin." But it wasn't color. It was legal definition. And sometimes this came up unexpectedly. Succession, probate and succession, for example, property starts becoming in space and place, and this is something that historians have raised, which I'm really trying to look at in literature, starts becoming problematic because in these interracial placage unions, the transference of property, of course, to the offspring of these unions would get tremendously complicated. And in a probate case, well, that's where family and lineage and everything becomes public record. And so it is tremendously complex, and there's no one answer to what made somebody fit what category, because this is the point at which I think it becomes evident how much race is a construct of the social order and a cultural concept. I was reading Tocqueville, a very short passage from Tocqueville with some students this morning, in which he's talking about the three races. And he observes, this is not in Louisiana, but it is in the antebellum South, our Frenchman observing democracy in America is watching a young white child, a Native American woman and a woman of color, and speaking about the way the white child just acts with superiority as if it's inbred. And he speaks of the distance that laws and prejudices have placed between them, not of any physical or genetic definition of race.
You mentioned poetry. What kinds of poems do you find when you look at these free people of color from New Orleans?
Well, poetry, I mean, as these writers would understand it, was in a very broad sense and not simply, in terms of versification. So what we see in the poetry is largely an echo of French Romanticism, and that was the same for writers of predominantly European descent, too. But when we look underneath that, underneath this interiority, this contemplation of nature, I think we see a profound testimony to the voice and to the capacity for literature to give voice to an otherwise silenced people through means of some very oblique critiques and commentaries. And I do want to speak about poetry very explicitly in terms of an 1845 collection of poems by 17 free people of color. But in order to set that up, and that one was called Les Senelles, or the Holly Berries, and it's certainly something that other scholars have considered. In order to set that up, I would like to consider some texts that are not as well known, that I think are what contribute to this constellation of themes, one of them being this institution of placage, and give it meaning in this indirect and oblique way. So I would take you back to 1843, to a very short-lived literary journal called L'Album Littéraire. And I have only seen copies of it at Amistad Research Center at Tulane University. There are certainly copies in other major archives in the United States. But it is not something that we're even sure we have all of the issues. I was trying to say numéro in French, issues that were printed. But two that we do have are July 15th and August 15th of 1843. And in those two issues, we find no fewer than four poems or stories that explicitly or implicitly are evoking placage. One that is a rewriting of basically a La Fontaine fable in which animal imagery and species difference is going to indicate racial difference. One short story in which the narrator happens upon the funeral of someone who turns out to be a placé who committed suicide and is just drawn into this very intimate sphere and space. But what I would rather concentrate on is a story that is very clearly signed, because many of these texts were anonymous, especially the ones that had these potentially subversive references. But there is one that is signed the name Armand Lanus. And Lanus was one of the leaders of the Créole de Couleur at Belém, New Orleans. He was a writer. He was a teacher at the Institut Couvent, which was basically the school for this community. And he appears to be to really harp on this issue, to come back to this issue of placage in his writing. And in a sense, before we get to his short story in which he is treating placage rather explicitly, I want to consider that writing in itself was an assertion of identity, perhaps a social critique and perhaps an act of resistance, in that writing is asserting literacy, it's asserting education. It's happening in French, in the United States, and the Album Littéraire had as their Latin motto, basically, a learned man will always have riches within himself. In essence, a self-definition that is not so much based on color as it is on cultural and intellectual lineage, which in this case is traced quite directly back to France. And so within the pages of this journal, we find one particular story, A Marriage of Conscience, and it is signed Armand Lanus, so his last name is truncated, but we all know it is Armand Lanus. It is a gripping tale, but we can see how the strategies that writers are using, a co-author of mine who wrote on a topic close to this, called it displaced resistance, in that the institution is not named. The character who gets the blame is the Creole mother who wants to place her daughter for financial gain. And racial difference is evoked quite obliquely. We start We're assuming the narrator is a free man of color. From his geographic mobility, he's strolling around the streets of New Orleans and walking in the front doors of the church. And it is there, the church being St. Louis Cathedral, as we are not explicitly named, but led to believe by the geography described here, he overhears a woman's prayer, a distressed woman who is recounting the story of her ruination before the altar of Mary. So the frame tale gives way to him listening to this particular prayer. And we learn that she's lived a very sheltered life and is then pressured by her mother and sisters to attend balls that Lanusse's readers wouldn't need anything more. They would know these were the quadroon balls. She falls into the charm of a certain Gustave at one of these balls. And her mother has to explain to this poor naive girl the legal impossibility of her marriage to Gustave. But she does it not in terms of racial difference, but Lanusse writes, I translation here, "But when the woman who brought me into the world tried to make me understand that this young man could not legally wed me because his social situation was superior to ours, I hid my face in my hands and withdrew my indignant heart. Indeed, Gustave did not want me as a wife, only as a mistress." So what we get here are some key elements of the Plassage narrative as deployed in this fiction. The greedy mother, who is trying to place the daughter for her own financial gain. The purity of the Placé, who in this case is very naive, and it then gives the writer a pretext for having to have everything explained, who is very naive, and I don't think that the Marian imagery would have been lost on Lanusse's readers. She's crying in front of the altar of Mary, whom she identifies as her patron saint. And this appeared on August 15th, the Feast of the Assumption, which probably didn't pass unnoticed in New Orleans in 1843. So what ultimately happens in this story is that the woman accepts the office of a marriage of conscience from Gustave. But his conscience ultimately carries little weight, and he soon takes a legitime code for white,
yes,
wife, shuns his place and her newborn child. The child dies a few days later. She slips into his insanity, goes to the church, and he hears this prayer. At the end of the prayer, the story returns to the frame narrator, who watches the woman leave the cathedral in a fit. Proper names fall away, and we move very much from the specific to the general in the end of this story.
He says, "I followed the unfortunate woman outside where she stopped on the sidewalk of the church. Just then, an elegant coach pulled by two feisty horses passed by on the cobblestone street. A very beautiful young woman and a well-groomed gentleman sat inside. The crazy woman stared intently inside the carriage and then cried out, 'It's him!' I saw her run in front of the horses. 'Stop!' cried people from all around. It was too late. The driver managed to regain control of the horses and halt them, but they brutally trampled the poor young woman as her body writhed under their hooves. I glanced at the couple riding in the carriage. The young lady seemed to shiver all over with pity. The face of the elegant gentleman was of a livid pallor. His entire body was paralyzed with fear. The bloody corpse of the young woman was transported to the town hall and placed under the peristyle." "So was she indeed crazy?" asked the compassionate voice of the lady riding in the coach. "Yes, ma'am," I cried out. "She lost her mind because some despicable coward took advantage of her simplicity and ruthlessly tricked her. And this coward, ma'am, he's—" "Whip the horses!" The pale gentleman, suddenly recovering from his stupor, abruptly screamed at the coachman. The coachman obeyed the order, and the horses galloped off. The young lady leaned toward me, vainly struggling to hear the last words I had uttered. Armand L.
Signed Armand L. Yes. Which was quite clearly at the time Armand Lanusse signing his own name. And not only is his name truncated, but the end of what the narrator wanted to say, which was to speak Gustave's name,
yes,
to his legitimate white wife, was truncated. And in the silencing of the narrator's revelatory words, the text ending with this ellipse, we see that the narrator cannot speak the white man's name, just like Armand Lanusse cannot speak the white man's name so directly, it is quite reflective of Plassage narratives and the social situation of these writers in general. There's a fascinating evocation of color here, the pale purse, the livid
yes.
pallor, which certainly the tragic events that unfold could have provoked the livid pallor. But we've already been told this person is pale, and so we're kind of getting an accumulation of,
just
of
got
color
paler.
Terms. He just got paler. And the readers wouldn't have needed that reinforcement. At this point, we are really seeing Lanusse drive his point home. And so in a sense, this text reflects the silence and the oppression in which these writers live, but also represents the ways in which they transgressed it, which was in part by narrating that very same silence.
We'll look further at madness and Plassage and color and New Orleans when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Jennifer Gibson, and we're talking about the free people of color in New Orleans and the literature that came out of this little-known period of time. One of the passages that we were reading referred to a woman as crazy, and it does seem to me that maybe some of the writers at this time, with all these murky distinctions in race, where just a small drop of one descent could lead you to have different legal status, could lead to a whole series of expectations. There must have been some question as to what was sane when the whole system was crazy.
Right. And Lanusse has set it up as so that she is insane, and we pity. It is somewhat melodramatic in that it is attempting, it does a very much evoke pity for this beautiful woman who now has disheveled hair and who is sobbing before the altar of Mary, oblivious to what is going on around her. But Lanusse, I think A Mariage de Conscience very much condenses so many of the elements that we see in these Plassage narratives, including some that are not signed, as this one was. Lanusse gets a little more daring and a lot more concise in 1845, and in the space of an 8-line poem called Epigram. This was in this poetry anthology that I think we alluded to earlier, Les Sennelles, 1845, the work of 17 free men of color from New Orleans, published in New Orleans. There is certainly a theme of the balls and the moral dangers, and I am not the first person to notice this in Les Sennelles, but I think that when we read it in relation to the Album Littéraire and A Mariage de Conscience, we start to see some things come together. Again, we have the villainization of the Creole mother, and this one is, as I was starting to talk about space and place and property and ownership and geographic mobility and who could go where, this is a very fascinating one because we've again penetrated into an intimate space. The man of color cannot penetrate into the doors of the Quadrian Ballroom. He can walk through the front doors of the St. Louis Cathedral, but he cannot walk through the back doors of the Quadrian Ballroom. And he cannot have access to the Plassage bed, nor can he have access to some of the women of his community here. But in the space of literature, we go into intimate spaces. And this particular poem called Epigram, Armand Lanusse, happens in a confessional. And we have basically a dialogue between the mother, who wants to place her daughter, the Creole woman, and the priest. I read, "So, you do not wish to renounce Satan?" said a good pastor to a certain bigot, who with a substantial list of weighty sins came once a year to relate to him the endless account. "I want to repent," she said, "forevermore. But before the first glimmer of grace purges my soul of all sinful desires, can I only pastor?" "Well, what? Place my daughter?" So the writer's visible object of scorn is this woman of color who wants the white man to pay for her daughter's favor, but the white man is never explicitly evoked. So what Plassage did is it allowed writers to speak about race without needing to specify it, because by simply setting up these situations, it was culturally legible to their readers what racial associations were at stake here. And I think that literature is a way of breaking down these barriers,
sure,
of where they could not go. And it's creating literary geographies that spoke to their own social predicaments. And so this overhearing a stranger's prayer, intruding upon a stranger's funeral. And in that story, Marie, she also was named Marie, Mary, and ended up being a Placé who commits suicide. In this confessional here, we have a way to evoke race without explicitly mentioning it. And I think it shows why literary depictions of Plassage did not need to correspond to historical reality of what the institution may or may not have been to respond to the very real historical conditions in which these créoles de couleur, these free men of color, lived.
What other sorts of writing, what other sort of genres do you find besides poetry, besides short fiction, after the 1840s?
Well, some of them a little bit unexpected, including the spiritualist papers. These are spiritualist circles holding seances, and this was across racial lines. On the cover of the spiritualist papers, you see a black hand and a white hand holding on to each other. So we have seances with Washington, Jesus, Voltaire, you name it. And Washington, of course, is speaking French and elaborating on what appears to be the motto of liberty, equality, and fraternity, which I think had a little bit more to do with the French nation, the American nation. Yeah. But, you know, the spiritualist papers continue after the Civil War. After the Union occupation of New Orleans, which is 1862, the Civil War starting in April of 1861, we see the rise of two newspapers. First, the Union, L'Union, which was run by the then free persons of color, and they were printing works such as La Marseillaise Noire, the Black Marseillaise, a rewriting of the French national anthem, which is a war revolutionary song, to be a song of peace. We see the Tribune of New Orleans, La Tribune de la Nouvelle-Orléans, succeeding the newspaper L'Union, and these newspapers providing very much a means of self-situation, of juxtaposing these writers' own works with that of Victor Hugo, who was writing about, had already written rather, about John Brown in the United States, of juxtaposing the news of New Orleans with the news that they are just quoting out of the newspapers from France. And that's part of what we miss when we see these poems reprinted in anthologies.
The context.
Is that context and all of these voices, which is very powerful in the context of a newspaper. But to speak about reprinting, which in a sense can be rewriting, I would like to go back in time to the Battle of New Orleans and then forward to the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, when the Battle of New Orleans and the legacy of the free men of color, their participation in it, is weaved into the same cultural narrative that will account for Plessy versus Ferguson. The crushing defeat that Separate but Equal was for this community, and how through writing they attempted still to make sense of it, to speak of it, and to look forward.
So tell us about Plessy.
Well, Plessy, Omer Plessy, was arrested in 1892 on the East Louisiana Railroad. And what was behind him, though, is this committee of the Citizens Committee. And among them was a man by the name of Rudolph Desdunes, who worked at the customs house by profession, I believe. And he would go on to write Our People, Our History, which ends with rich chronicles the history of his people, which in its essence tries to rewrite a certain part of American history and how his people had been covered. It starts with the Battle of New Orleans and the glory of the free people of color and Andrew Jackson's call to, as sons of freedom, you're called upon to defend our most inestimable blessing as Americans, etc. And the free militia of color that fought with great courage at New Orleans in what was a crushing defeat of the British in the face of Jackson pirates, free persons of color, and everyone else. They managed this ragtag band of, quote, Americans, many of whom definitely did not identify in that way. And there was a poem called The Campaign of 1814, 1815, which the narrator says, "I remember one childhood day my mother said to me with a sigh, 'My child, vision of innocence, you do not know what fate awaits you beneath this beautiful sky. You think you see your country. But see the error of your ways, my tender son. And above all, believe your dear mother. Here, you are but an object of scorn.'" 10 years later, across our vast frontiers, the British cannon sounded and evoked these words. "Come, my brothers, forward to victory. We are all born of Louisiana blood." With these sweet words, after embracing my mother, I followed and echoed your cries, not thinking in my war-crossed road that I was only an object of scorn. So the narrator of the poem, of course, fights on the battlefield and is promised the same glory and treatment as everybody else. And indeed, the veterans of New Orleans were promised the same pensions as the white soldiers who fought there. And the poem ends, "But today I sadly sigh, for I see that all has changed. I no longer see that gracious smile that sparkled on your honeyed lips. Have you now become my enemies? Ah, I see it in your fierce glances. I am nothing but an object of scorn." This poem was published in 1911 in Dedun's book, Our People, Our History, and was said to have been preserved in his family papers. And what is very interesting to me is what he does with this poem and with the site of collective memory that was the Battle of New Orleans for French speakers, black and white, a very important point for defining themselves in relation to the American whole and in opposition to, of course, the invading British. But Dedun ends his book by speaking of one of the members of the Citizens Committee, the people who brought forth Plessy versus Ferguson, and saying, "Thanks to him, each move of the committee was a success. The courts, it is true, rejected our demands. But thanks to the good and loyal labors of Monsieur Bonsejour, our people had the satisfaction of pushing the American government to a wall by acting through the ministry of one of its constituent branches. A worthy son of a veteran of 1814, 1815, this valiant citizen resisted the unprecedented usurpation inspired by hatred and prejudice to the best of his ability. Future generations will remember him." I don't know that future generations remember Monsieur Bonsejour, but I think future generations remember, though it may be divorced from its origins, the work of the Citizens Committee. And I would close with two more quotes from Dedun's book. One is Dedun quoting Montesquieu, French Enlightenment philosopher, "An injustice committed against one person is a threat against everybody." And then Dedun follows up with that at the end on his own words. "We think that it is more noble and dignified to fight, no matter what, than to show a passive attitude of resignation. Absolute submission augments the oppressor's power and creates doubt about the feeling of the oppressed." And this book, this history of his people, has such a heavy feel if read from beginning to end, because he speaks of the glory of the musicians, of the writers, of the architects that came from his community. But he is writing it from the point of view of a man whose people have known a crushing, crushing defeat, and who, looking back on the antebellum days of free persons of color relative to their ancestors, in terms simply of geographic mobility, of access to doors, to drinking fountains, have lost. And in this separate but equal, the Anglo-American binary has named them colored. Dedun has written back, in French, mind you, and published in Canada, and named himself and his people Creole, Creole.
Jennifer Gibson, thanks for joining us for this hour and looking into that colorful world of New Orleans, especially, is before the Civil War, but going right on up to the 20th century, too. Plenty there.
My thanks to y'all for having me.
And if we can, we'll go out with some music, which would be?
Music of Basile Barrès, who may or may not have been born a slave and probably composed the piece that we are going to hear while he was still enslaved. Biographical information being a little bit thin, but he was one of the musicians who would go on to, after the Civil War, be very much part of this cultural scene.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.